predictions that you would be reluctant to make at the moment is about one of those areas of conflict, an Islamic Republic, and that is in Iran, of course, because as we speak, that situation is developing very fast. But let me push you to some kind of a prediction, what may happen, not just with Iran and its internal problems, but with its relationship with its neighbours and with the West over the nuclear issue.
I think there is going to be, finally, you might say, a serious attempt to dissuade Iran by much tougher sanctions. My guess is that that is going to be led by America unilaterally, with a United Nations effort perhaps following behind. And I think the US effort may have some chance of success. That may slow Iran down. It seems to me Iran has been quite careful not to take things to the brink, where it may provoke an Israeli airstrike, as people have been talking about for some time. But increasingly less careful, one has to say. So I think that one is very hard to predict. I still would tend to think that conflict is less likely than many people predict.
A more fragmented world than in 2010, both economically, in social terms, in geopolitical terms, and over the environment? That's what you seem to be saying, Gillian.
I think that's a tremendous risk. I mean, right now, more than ever, we see why countries need to cooperate, while international collaboration needs to be genuine. And yet now more than ever, it's becoming harder to put that into practice because of these rising economic pressures and associated political pressures too.
Bronwyn Maddox, Gillian Tett there talking about the power balance in the world. Now, of course, what affects that very centrally is how strong the US government is seen. And you'd had a sense in 2009 that Barack Obama is seen as somebody who's still learning his craft, who is indecisive, has all these reviews, hasn't really pushed his party strongly enough to come up with the laws, with the rules, with the expectations that he offered voters back in 2008. How fair is that? And do you see that changing in 2010? Is he going to be a bit more decisive?
I'd give him better marks than you've just done. I think if you think right in the first few weeks of his presidency, he organised the financial bailout, or the bailout of the banks, the stimulus of the economy, rescue of the car industry. He had the advantage of a crisis, but in the famous saying of his chief of staff, he didn't waste it. He's found things tougher since then, and that's not surprising given how much he took on. I think he goes into this into 2010 with a pretty firm record behind him. I don't myself think Copenhagen was a failure. I think what it showed, which was not surprising, was that rich and poor countries see things differently, big and small countries see things differently. And it may be very, very difficult to get big United Nations agreements through in the same way. And the big test of that in 2010 is going to be the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which sprawls over the whole of May, this conference to try and review it. But Obama, you know, he brought Copenhagen to a head. He had the conversations face-to-face with the Chinese leaders that mattered. And that seems to me shows an ability to bring things to the point and to address the issues that matter. So I think I'd give him good marks in prospect for the year ahead, which is, after all, what the Nobel Committee did.
Gillian Tett, what are you looking forward to in 2010?
I think the key issue I'll be watching out for is how people around me actually adjust to the idea that there's going to have to be some very nasty decisions made going forward. How America adjusts to a world of more constrained resources and tough choices and having to cope with a shrinking pie is going to be a very interesting question indeed.
Bronwyn?
Professionally, I care about the nuclear proliferation treaty and would hope for progress on that. And I'm also looking forward to going to Japan in the next few weeks. I entirely agree with Gillian that it's too often left on the side as a society, very separate and enormously interesting and important in the year coming with a brand new government. We don't know what's coming from it. Personally, it's been a rough year for a lot of people. I'm looking for just things to feel more cheerful on all kinds of fronts, particularly in Britain.
Abdurrahman?
You know, I think it's easy to get caught up in the malaise and the cynicism of looking at global politics and the big issues. And I 2 years ago, I moved to East London in a community that's as diverse and multicultural and multi-faith as East London. I see a lot of cause for hope, and I certainly hope that'll continue.
And that was Abdulrahman Malik, and we also heard from Bronwyn Maddox of The Times and Gillian Tett of The Financial Times, all talking to Dan Damon. Well, we're sticking with The Times now, The Times of London, because you can trace its history right back to 1785, really, to this day in 1785, although, to be fair, when it first came out, it was actually called the Daily Universal Register, but that doesn't take away from the fact that it is a direct line of the same newspaper all those years. And today, The Times has reprinted its first edition. And Michael Binion is a foreign affairs specialist at the Times newspaper in London. So we looked at the first edition of the paper.
It's full of all kinds of little tidbits. There's not a lot of news in it. It's a massive amount of opining by the editor, and there's some short ads about people who want positions. But there's a column and a bit of foreign intelligence, as they call it, what we would know as foreign news.
Yeah, so this is your bit as a foreign correspondent.
That's right. That's right. I mean, there's some wonderfully short and fairly lively little items. There's one here from Paris, December the 20th, and it goes like this. We are informed of an answer made by the King of Prussia to the Commandant of Cleves, who wanted to know of His Majesty how he was to act if the Austrian troops should attempt to pass through his territories. The answer was that if the Austrian troops marched towards the Duchy of Cleves, he should tell them that they had mistaken the way. If they persisted, he should make prisoners of them. And if they resisted, kill them. Signed, Frederick.
Sorry, nice Frederick, and short and sharp. Frederick, you'd have got 5,000 words out of that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You wouldn't have left it. That's only got about one little paragraph. Right, well, underneath that, we got this. Yesterday, their majesties came from Windsor. That's Windsor Castle, presumably, where the royals still live. And last night honoured the theatre with their presence. This day being New Year's Day, their majesties will appear in the drawing room at St James's, that's where Prince Charles now lives, and receive the compliments of the nobility, gentry and foreign ministers on the occasion of the day. And, oh, look, the following ode. So there's a poem from the poet Lord.
Oh, yes,
there.
It's rather long. It's a very worthy piece of poetry.
I don't think we want to read it all out. So what do you make of it? I mean, it's actually, you know, people complain today that there's too much opinion in the papers, but apart from these short snippets, this is full of editorialising.
Oh,
as well.
Yes, oh, yes. And also a lot of concealed advertising. I mean, the founder, John Walter, wanted to promote his kind of printing method. He had spent a lot of money trying to invent a way of printing more cheaply. Instead of single letters being picked up, he grouped them into actually preformed words. Lithography, it was called. It never worked, but he thought that the Times would be a way of promoting this. And there are shameless advertisements about how wonderful this printing process is. And in his long editorial to readers, he says, this is one of the reasons I'm going to do this, and I'll sell it for a halfpenny cheaper than any other newspaper, and it will address all the issues of the day, and it will be of use to lords and servants and literary people alike. And he also says, and it won't have too much stuff from Parliament. He said that all the other newspapers endlessly went on and on about Parliament, and as a result, they missed the deadlines.
How many of the 225 years have you worked?
Well, quite a lot of them.
Go on.
Well, I was part of the programme the BBC made 25 years ago on the 200th anniversary. And I remember very well coming out to be interviewed about what I thought of the Times and what it was like working. I was then correspondent in Bonn. And, of course, I mean, I was interviewed by journalists, so you have to remember, when you're interviewed by journalists, be very careful. I spoke for about an hour. It was cut right back to about half a minute, and the only bit they used was the only criticism I made.
Well, that's what you've done to
that's
others.
That's exactly right. That's how it always is.
Will it last another 225? No, it'll be online.
Well, it'll be online, and whether there will still be a paper edition, I don't know. I mean, it's quite resilient still, that people still buy newspapers. So I have to say, not many people under 30 actually buy the printed edition. Most people read it online.
Just quickly, when you joined, it was the paper of the British establishment.
Very much so.
Is it now?
Up to a point. It doesn't like to boast that it is. It once had an advertising slogan, top people take the Times, and that's how it used to think of itself. Now it's just one of several what they call quality newspapers. But I would like to think that it is really one that the establishment, if such a thing exists, still reads, and reads carefully.
There we are, veteran Times correspondent Michael Binion. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. And a couple of headlines. A suicide car bomb attack at a volleyball tournament in the northwestern region of Pakistan has killed more than 85 people. And the Islamist group Al-Shabaab in Somalia says it is prepared to send fighters across the sea to Yemen to support Islamic militants there. Now, there was a time when it looked like Russia was heading towards liberal democracy, when satirists and TV programme makers in Moscow competed with the cruelest satirists in the West when it came to poking fun at their leaders. There was, for example, a Russian version of the British TV show Spitting Image, in which politicians were represented by puppets and really were ridiculed. And it was an innovation that didn't really survive the Putin era. Soon after he came to power, that programme was taken off air. But some Russian programme makers have now come up with a rather milder lampooning of President Medvedev and Prime Minister Putin, again in cartoon form, and it's just been broadcast.
Верьте вы или не верьте, каждый день я в интернете.
Знаю. Я ведь нет да нет вам пишу «Привет, Медведь».
Well, there we are. Those are the two characters, Putin and Medvedev, and they're sort of singing and dancing around, I think in Red Square, and playing an accordion and a tambourine. Well, Alexander Nekrasov is a former Kremlin advisor during the Yeltsin years, now a journalist in London. And he's actually writing a satire on Russian politics called Crème de la Kremlin. What does he think of this cartoon?
Well, I found that this cartoon was quite complimentary, very complimentary, actually, to Mr. Putin and Mr. Medvedev. And every point made in this cartoon actually makes them look good, because the puppets themselves were dancing sort of merrily and looked a bit odd in a sense. But what they were actually saying, that they were in control of events, which I found remarkable.
I see. So it's one of these things that looks like satire, but actually isn't.
Well, satire has long been dead, political satire in Russia, to be honest with you. This was a product of the spin doctors. I was one of the first spin doctors in the Kremlin. I actually invented spin for the Kremlin.
Nothing to be proud of.
Nothing to be proud of, but at that time I was defending the Kremlin and President Yeltsin from the communists. So we didn't want them to come back to power. So, you know, we were trying to do our best. And this time, on this occasion, I can see the spin doctors really, really having a serious involvement in this cartoon.
Oh, well, the TV station, or at least some of the people at the TV station, deny that. They say, you know, that they're going carefully, they're trying to expand the boundaries, that they didn't get permission for this, that they're, you know, putting their toe in the water, that sort of thing.
I would disagree with that completely, because, first of all, there's nothing of that sort of entertainment that goes without the consent of the Kremlin spin doctors. Nothing. That has to be approved there. The censorship in this respect is very tight in Russia at the moment. Everything to do with the leadership has to be censored by the Kremlin.
When were the best jokes in Russian politics?
Well, the best times we in political satire, it was underground, obviously. It was under Brezhnev, Leonid Brezhnev, and some of the consecutive leaders. And Gorbachev, yes, that was a fun time too, because he was very, very unpopular, deeply unpopular in Russia from the word go. And there were very many jokes about him.
You're saying on TV it's, you know, impossible, really, to have real satire. What about the internet? Are people, are young Russians or older Russians, are they writing away, making videos, poking fun, having a go?
Yes, internet is completely different. And you would see some of the websites, very funny. Grani.ru, for example, TV, is absolutely astonishingly funny. And it portrays Putin and Medvedev as two incompetent fools, basically, who don't know what they're doing. I mean, some of that stuff, I'm amazed it actually comes out in Russia. And the bloggers, they have a life of their own there. And you would not find any popularity ratings of 70% on the blogs, you know, that Putin supposedly enjoys. You would see very, very bitter, I would say, comments about him. And, of course, ridiculing him a lot, and Medvedev as well.
And the spin doctors can't stop it?
Well, the spin doctors have their own websites, and they obviously introduce their own opposite sort of political satire, and they're trying to play it safe. And I mean, unfortunately, you know, when I invented the spin doctoring, spin for the Kremlin, I didn't really understand that I was creating a Frankenstein monster, because I thought it would help, you know, to stop the communists winning power, because that was unthinkable in those days, in the 90s. But then this machine turned around, and it's now fighting the war with its people. And that's what I find actually very disappointing. But I think personally, as it happened with communism collapsed mostly because it was ridiculed by the Russians themselves. And when you are being ridiculed as a politician, basically your cred is out of the window. I think this regime will fall under the weight of that ridicule too, because you can't really control political satire, and especially in the age of internet. You just can't. It's impossible. It gets out of control. And what I'm seeing on the internet, on the Russian internet, I can tell you there are some serious jokes there and some serious ridicule going on.
And that was Alexander Nekrasov.
I'll have a decaf coffee.
I'll have a decaf espresso.
I'll have a double decaf cappuccino.
Give me decaf and a coffee ice cream.
I'll have a half double decaffeinated yeah. half cap with a twist of lemon.
Well, it isn't easy buying a cup of coffee these days, and not only because you've got to describe what goes in it, there's also the matter of the coffee cup size. How big is tall? How small is regular? No one really knows, according to the Plain English campaign, which is upset by the difficulty of ordering a decent cup of coffee. It says describing a coffee as regular is meaningless, and customers should simply get offered small, medium, or large. Well, Steve Jenner is from the Plain English campaign, and I suggested to him that there's no way, really, this campaign to get the coffee chains to change their labelling is going to work.
Oh, I should think we might.
Do you?
Oh, I think so.
Go on,
because
tell me.
Well, because sometimes you don't know whether regular means small or regular means medium.
You certainly don't, but the point is that in a year's time, do you really believe that these coffee shops will say, OK, we'll call them small, medium and large?
I think so. If your listeners actually revolted and went into the coffee shop and said, instead of I'll have a regular, said, I want an irregular, and when they look at you blankly, say, yeah, I want all the piranhas in.
The irregular coffee?
Yes, all right. Or the iceberg. I'll have that one.
Now then, we're at the end of a year. As you look back, we're thinking we've got quite a few new phrases which have come up. Extraordinary rendition. What do you make of that?
Well, it's OK to take people overseas or into different countries to torture them if you're in a country where it's illegal to torture people.
No, but not the politics of it. The phrase. Is it a phrase that actually describes what happened?
Well, it's a phrase which is a euphemism, isn't it? It's a euphemism for exactly what I just said. Basically, we use a lot of euphemistic language to cover up things which are, for many people, unacceptable.
I see what you mean. Sexing up?
Well, yes.
That was used. That's become a big phrase in British politics now. When it basically means when the government spins something, when it exaggerates something.
Well, yes, to sex that up. Sometimes you talk about sexing up a 16-page document on what to do with yogurt. You know, it's not exactly right, is it? You don't think, sexy at that. No, it just doesn't work.
Quantitative easing?
Quantitative easing, spraying a load of money about. Well, once again, do you mean quantitative? What's easing about printing a load of fivers? I don't get that. It doesn't even describe what it attempts to euphemise. I don't know.
All right, there's one phrase that I'd never heard of before. Apparently this is from American Airlines. And yes. I mean, as a man from the Plain English campaign, you cannot like this. Apparently it's when you've lost your baggage, they call it... Yeah. A property irregularity event or something?
Yes, a property irregularity receipt is what you get. Means we've lost your bag, unlucky.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't, does it? You can't, if you get one of those, you'd be incandescent with rage.
All right, so your top hope for the year?
Well, really, I think look back over the decade and look at some of the things we've redacted. You know, we've crossed out bits of this document, the embarrassing bits about MPs' expenses.
Funnily enough, we had the woman who broke that story yesterday and said she didn't like the word redacted. She calls it censorship.
Well, yes, exactly. Crossing out censorship, which is what a lot of people would consider.